From Istanbul, Turkey, I'm Suzek Rolat, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. Firat Demir, Professor of Economics at the University of Oklahoma and co-leader of the University's Journey to Turkey program, joins me today to discuss the global response to this week's devastating tornado in Oklahoma.
People identify themselves with the victims and show empathy, and especially in Turkey, which faced major earthquakes in the past, and people can connect with it.
And I'll talk with University of Oregon political scientist Richard Krauss about how art and culture become a testing ground between the United States and China.
We'll often use it positively. Okay, gee, we'll send them some poets and then they'll love us more. But when things are not going particularly well, the arts become a flashpoint.
He's the author of several books about music, calligraphy, and art during China's Cultural Revolution. These conversations after the latest news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzek Rolat. Firat Demir, thank you for joining me for the roundtable today.
Thank you, Suzek, for having me.
So here we are in Istanbul, Turkey, and yet the news of the week is, of course, back at home in Oklahoma with the very large tornado that went through Moore earlier in the week. It's been very interesting as we're here overseas that there's been a huge international outpouring of support. Everybody we've met here in Turkey, once they know we're from Oklahoma, they're giving us their condolences. It's on the front page of the Turkish newspaper. It's on the news in Turkey. And my colleagues from around the world have been writing in and sending emails, and our partners, our university partners, have been calling and sending emails of support. Why is it that, do you think, people are so interested around the world in this type of event?
I think it's not the event itself, but people identify themselves with the victims and show empathy, and especially in Turkey, which faced major earthquakes in the past, and people can connect with, and with the pictures of the elementary school and the kids dying and losing their lives, people do really connect with it, and many of our students here are showing, and newspapers are full of pictures of those little kids and the teachers helping them out. And people put themselves in their shoes and think what would happen if it was them, and just show empathy, which I think is a good sign of how people actually do connect, reach out to each other when it is needed, independent of different views on politics and identities, ideologies, and all that. I think there's a universal sense of connectedness and what it means to be human.
No, I think that's absolutely right, Firat. I mean, the fact that you say it's what it means to be human. You know, it makes us all human when we see these kinds of natural disasters, to be able to reach out and, like you say, empathize with people from around the world. So clearly, those all of us here in Turkey from Oklahoma and elsewhere around the world are thinking of our family members and our friends and our colleagues back at home. Well, so here in Turkey, let's turn to what's going on in Turkey. The Turkish Prime Minister recently visited President Obama in Washington and spoke about some of his main concerns, one of which is the growing and perhaps spreading civil conflict in Syria. Is this the issue that is of most importance today to the Turkish government?
I would say one of the key issues, because Turkey has 710 kilometer long border with Syria, and there was just last month a major bombing in Antioch, in southeastern Turkey, that killed 50 people, and they pinpoint the Syrian Secret Service for organizing it. And most Turks and people in Turkey are scared that the civil conflict in Syria may spread to Turkish borders and grow out of control. Many of the tourist guides here in Istanbul were showing concerns that what would happen if a bomb explodes in Istanbul would bring the entire tourism industry to a halt here in the city. So they don't want to be involved in the civil conflict, but they cannot stay out of it either, because they have a very long border and they have family members on both sides of the border itself, actually. So the Turkish side, I think, is asking for a more direct involvement from the U.S. side, and they were asking for more support. So I think they are left in between a crossfire now. They don't know if they involve, if they intervene directly themselves. They are afraid they will be left out, and plus they will be a part of the civil war, and it may grow out of proportion and damage Turkey big time. And this is at a significant point, because Turkey just for the last 4 months is making the biggest, single biggest important change in its history by making a ceasefire and with Kurds. So first time the 80-year-old civil conflict is about to come to an end within its borders with its Kurdish minority population, recognizing their cultural rights and others. The Kurdish guerrillas of PKK are withdrawing from Turkish borders, and it looks like that it will end up good. Most people among Kurdish population are very optimistic about this. And the last thing now a citizen of Turkey wants is to have another civil conflict after all this 80-year-old bloody conflict that is ending, and they want to stay out of it. But there are still other concerns too. So Syrian conflict, the Kurdish issue, which is going good, but another concern among the public is the increasing authoritarian tendencies of the government and the Erdogan government particularly. The best example of this was the May Day celebrations here in Istanbul, and the government, fearing of opposition under the pretext of some construction projects, did not allow labor unions to use the main square, the Taksim Square of Istanbul, for protests. And to prevent people from protesting, they actually stopped ferry services, bus services, and they opened up bridges to prevent people from crossing to the other side. So it looked like an entire city of 17 million people under siege on that single day, which when he was asked, he explained, saying that, well, they were not there to celebrate May Day, but to protest against our government. And that is the fear.
Well, clearly, it's a beautiful city, a wonderful part of the world, but also very complicated. They're dealing with a lot of complicated issues, not only internally, but externally. So thank you so much, Farhad, for being with us today. It's a very interesting time to be in Turkey. And again, we're thinking of everyone at home.
Thanks for hearing me.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this show or answer any questions you may have. Write to us at worldviews@ou.edu or send us a tweet at worldviewskgou. Coming up, I'll have a conversation with University of Oregon political scientist Richard Krauss. He's written several books about how music, art, and even the handwriting of public officials can intersect with politics. Professor Richard Krauss, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
We have a really interesting background, the work that you've been doing on China and culture, and in particular, all kinds of culture and cultural relations. But I'd like to ask you about some of the books that you've written, Pianos and Politics in China. What do pianos have to do with politics in China?
Pianos have everything to do with politics in China because during the Chinese Cultural Revolution, 1966-76, for a while, the piano was regarded as the ultimate expression of the bourgeoisie. You know, it's a creature of Western high art. It was something that young Chinese middle-class students would study. They'd learn to play their Chopin, their Beethoven. And in a period of radical politics, this was seen as a very reactionary, kind of art. And there were efforts to rid it. And sort of one of the intriguing side stories of the Cultural Revolution is that the radicals said, "Whoa, stop smashing pianos." Piano actually turned out to be a revolutionary instrument. Mao's wife decided she liked the piano. And there was then sort of the idea that you need to adapt Western technology and art to serve Chinese political purposes. So after about 1968, the piano was all right.
So clearly, China is such an interesting country and one that you really can't understand its politics unless you understand its culture. Is that right? I mean, it's the two really are ingrained so strongly. Is that different than any other country, would you say?
No. Fond as I am of studying Chinese culture, I'd still say, well, gee, there's some things you can't understand, like foreign trade statistics or numbers of submarines.
Currency valuation. Yeah, Does any of that stuff reflect any kind of culture?
These things are really important, and you don't really need to understand Chinese calligraphy to be able to tell what's going on here. But having said that, every country has its cultural quirks. And because China is so large and so old, Chinese politics culture plays probably a more obvious and accepted role than in American politics. And there's some moves that go on within the Chinese political game that if you understand where they're coming from, it helps.
So can you give me an example of how this kind of quirky cultural impact is reflected in political interactions in China?
Sure. A big deal is politicians' handwritings.
Okay.
Every great Chinese artist, that is, in the past, every Chinese who was educated well, is supposed to have pretty handwriting. And there's been a fetish of gorgeous calligraphy.
So you know, obviously, that because of the characters.
Because of the characters.
The beautiful. They take that very seriously.
They take it very seriously.
How you brush stroke out your characters.
And the elite status that formal education would give you. So for over 1,000 years, this has been a terribly important aspect. And every politician who rises to a position of power is expected to have beautiful calligraphy. In the last 100 years or so, some of them haven't. And they hire ghost calligraphers.
Is that right? I mean, this is interesting, right? We couldn't hold our own decision makers to having
hold
good
our own,
handwriting,
you know, even today,
or our physicians, for that matter. Right?
even today, the masthead of People's Daily is in Mao Zedong's calligraphy. Imagine if Barack Obama wrote the New York Times masthead. You know, we can't quite imagine something like this.
Yeah. And
so it provides a kind of cultural signal for people in, you know, who are paying attention to Chinese politics within China.
So those who actually achieve some level of really beautiful calligraphy in their handwriting, you can make some assumptions about their positions in politics?
No, you can't. And the system breaks down in part because the assumption is that your calligraphy reflects your inner soul. And that a beautiful hand shows a cultivated person. Every once in a while, of course, there's a politician who turns out to be a real rat whose handwriting was gorgeous. And so there's some episodes where people's calligraphy has been posthumously destroyed.
I love the title of one of your books here, Brushes with Power. So is this what you're talking about in that book, The Modern Politics and Chinese Art of Calligraphy, and how those in power typically demonstrate some sort of gift when it comes to – or they really cultivated that gift of calligraphy?
Yeah. And I got interested in this one morning waking up in China and realizing that there was Mao Zedong's calligraphy on the mosquito net that was over my head in a bed in Fujian province. And I thought, this is odd. And then the more I started looking into it, I discovered it was fake. Mao had never written the inscription for the name of the university where I was working at the time, but that they had pasted something together from other characters so as to
of his handwriting. And it's that detectable that you knew that it was –
it was immediately obvious whose handwriting it was. And somebody then confessed that, they had made at one point they wanted it to appear that Mao had been their patron.
So another one of your works I think is very interesting is your title is The Party and the Artie, China's New Politics of Culture. What does that mean, the party and the artie?
That's a study of the sort of long-term relationship since 1949, since the Chinese Revolution, of the party trying to organize artists and its successes and failures. And
so organizing the artists to promote the party
sometimes to promote the party line, but sometimes also just, artists have a high status in China. So it's a part of a broader, longer-term trend toward professionalizing artists, having more art schools, more conservatories, more arts teacher training programs. It's not all political control, but that is obviously a part of it also. And the question then, how much loyalty can you expect from an artist that whose salary you're paying?
Is this something also different in terms of that relationship between politicians and artists that you would find in China as opposed to the United States or other countries? I mean, do you find a similar relationship or a similar attempt to kind of capitalize on the knowledge of or the connections of artists or their fame, basically?
I think the U.S. is probably the outlier here. Where we've had a historically powerful resistance to government arts programs. We didn't have a national endowment for the arts until 1965. And as you know, every Congress, there's an effort to kill it off. Its budget never grows by very much. China has a tradition here that is, I think, taps into ideas that, the state should be a patron of the arts. for all the problems that may ensue from that, that you can find in in Russia or in Western European countries as well, with national arts academies and more generous state support.
My guest is Richard Krauss, a University of Oregon political scientist and the author of Pianos and Politics in China, Middle Class Ambitions and the Struggle Over Western Music. We'll talk more right after a break. I'm Suzette Gorlot, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews on KGOU. I'm Suzette Gorlot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. My guest today is University of Oregon political scientist Richard Krauss. When we left off, he described China's tradition of having the state serve as the main patron of the arts community.
So let's step a little beyond just looking at culture in China and its relationship to politics there. And can you say something about cultural relations between China and the U.S.? Do we see, because we have, we all know there's a friendship, but maybe one that is not necessarily the warmest of friendships. Is art and culture an area where we communicate with each other well, that we understand each other a little bit, that we engage with one another or not?
The word that I think of to describe our relationship, frenemies.
Frenemies.
You know that one.
And, I have some of those.
Yes, yeah, exactly. We all do. And U.S. and China, I think, have that relationship. And art becomes a kind of testing point for us. Where if things are going well, we'll have happy arts exchanges, and or we'll often use it positively. Okay, gee, we'll send them some poets, and then they'll love us more. But when things are not going particularly well, the arts become a flashpoint where we have disagreements, or we'll say they'll just reflect tensions in our relationship.
So, for example, when things aren't going well, how does it reflect? What is an example of how
it's a relatively recent, I think, kind of silly example, but it's real. One of China's great pianists is a man named Long Long. He's had great artistic success around the world. And a couple of years ago, he was invited to play at the White House. And among the things he played that night was a popular song in China about missing his homeland. And after he performed, somebody discovered that, that song was made popular in China from a movie, a 1950s movie about Chinese prisoners in the Korean War. And that it was thus an anti-American song that Long Long had snuck into the White House, and the Chinese were doing a secret victory dance that they'd showed, they trumped us somehow culturally. I think that's really stupid, but it had a life of its own, and there was an online debate about this that went on.
So there was a response. I mean, the White House responded
We're not enabling the Chinese to laugh at us about Korea.
They couldn't just see it for the music that it was, that there was some sort of other message.
Sometimes the music is just music.
Yeah.
So is there sometimes there is a barbed intent. And it's difficult to tell one from the other. And our frenemy relationship means that we're both a little suspicious. What are they really trying to pull on both sides?
So the United States, looking at China from the U.S. perspective now, I mean, the U.S. has kind of at least rhetorically said we're making some sort of pivot toward Asia and paying more attention to China. Do you really see that happening? Are we paying attention to China more than the Middle East these days? Or is it some sort of balance we're going to have to strike? Or
we're certainly talking about it.
We're
talking about it. I don't see it yet. The Chinese, of course, hope that they never see it. But,
I was going to say, how is that taken in China? I mean, so the Chinese don't want to see this pivot?
No.
they don't want to be watched any more than they feel like they are already.
They think they're being watched just fine as it is, yeah.
So again, that suspicious relationship, that frenemy relationship. What is it going to take to get us out of that? What's going to move us from being frenemies to friends, or, heaven forbid, from frenemies to enemies?
My hope is that we're economically entangled enough with China that, well, gee, we can't really do more than snarl at one another. But, of course, you know, people said that about Britain and Germany on the eve of World War I, and that didn't work out. So a lot of trade doesn't necessarily assure long-term peace. It's a help. And as you know, our economic penetration of China is vast, and everybody knows about Chinese investments in the United States, the amount of our foreign debt that is held by Chinese institutions, recently passed by Japan, I understand. Some things are a little less known. Like if you go to the movies in the United States these days, one out of three chance you'll see a movie in a Chinese-owned theater. China bought the AMC theaters last year.
This is definitely something we don't know about. I mean, China owns quite a bit of of American enterprises, and particularly entertainment enterprises.
Well, entertainment's important, and of course, some people will say, okay, are they going to start showing Chinese propaganda at the mall? And I think they bought them to make money, and that Chinese propaganda is probably not a good way to make money. But it's an interesting indication of how interpenetrated we are and how culture is a part of it.
So I guess basically at the end of the day, what I'm hearing you say is that we just still don't well understand one another, that there's not a significant amount of, again, the suspicion. Are we going to start seeing Chinese propaganda? Well, they probably just want to make money. I mean, we don't, I know, having spent some time in China, they're all about making money. As are Americans. We have that in common. So we just don't yet fully understand one another's position.
There are other countries we may not fully understand. The critical thing with China is that, they're a rising power and they're a rival to established American interests in the world. And, whatever you think about the oughts to be of that, it raises the stakes beyond, say, we don't understand Nepal very well either. And that's not a geopolitical issue that most Americans worry about.
So enhancing our awareness is a good thing all the way around.
Oh, sure. Of course.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Professor Krauss, for joining us today on Worldviews. I appreciate it.
It's a pleasure.
You've been listening to our conversation with Richard Krauss, a political scientist at the University of Oregon and the author of several books about the intersection of art and government in China. KGOU produces Worldviews alongside the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Brian Hardzinski produces and edits the show. Mackenzie Samus prepared the research for this interview. And we'd like to welcome our new digital content intern, Hallie Arias, to the staff. We'll continue our reporting next week from Turkey. For Ferhat Demir, I'm Suzette Rolat.